Welcome to you if you've joined us since we started. We're delighted you're able to be with us here this evening. I hope you've enjoyed your meal so far and had a nice time around your tables. You'll know that we live in an age where many people question and some deny altogether the claims of Christianity. And so we as a church like to organise evenings like this from time to time where we examine one key aspect of the Christian faith and give our friends the opportunity to question us on it. To help us do that this evening, we've got Charlie Screen, who's going to be speaking to us in just a few minutes' time. He'll be the next person that you see get up here a few minutes after I get down. Charlie's married to Claire and father to Tom, who's just coming up 15 months, he was telling me earlier. Charlie runs our work among students here. We have a good number of students that come to us week by week in term time when they can get out of bed. And when Charlie can get out of bed, he looks after them when they come to us. He travels around the country a bit, addressing questions like our topic this evening. So he's very well placed to help us as we address the question that I think gets right to the very heart of the Christian faith, namely, as you saw on the advertising, who is Jesus Christ? Just who was the man who's divided history in two? It's worth me saying that at the end of Charlie's talk, pudding will be brought to us around the tables, and then there'll be an opportunity to question Charlie if you've got any disagreements, any clarifications about anything that he said. And to that end, on your table, there are slips like this, question slips and some pens as well. And it'll be worth you scribbling down questions as we go. And then the stewards will come and collect the questions and Charlie will have a chance just to look over them before I put them to him later. So I hope that's everything that you need to know for now. Charlie will get up in a couple of minutes to speak, but until then, just carry on chatting around your tables.
Well, good evening, and thank you very much for being here. Has the tennis finished? Does anyone know? Has finished. That's not good news, is it? Okay, good. But thank you for being here, and thank you particularly. I think this is a really important issue tonight. Who is Jesus? Who is he? I want to start with a little warm-up exercise, a warm-up who is he exercise. So. Here we go, sort of guess who for grown-ups. So this one's easy. So 21-year-old Scottish man with terrible curly hair just lost a tennis match. You with him? Now, but who is he? Is he Britain's hero? Is he Britain's hero at the All England Tennis Club? Or is he a Scottish yob? And I guess, actually, I don't know whether the papers tomorrow will turn on him. Maybe, was it straight sets? Was it pretty dismal? See, 2 days ago, I read the papers on Tuesday, and it was just extravagant. There was one right-wing paper compared him to Margaret Thatcher. That's who he reminded them of, which I'm not sure Scottish 21-year-old really finds that flattering. But that's, I don't know who it'll be tomorrow. Is he the sort of bicep posturing, English-hating yob from Scotland? Here's another one. More complicated. Who is this? 84-year-old man, born in Zimbabwe, distinguished, wise-looking gentleman. Now, I guess if he'd died even maybe 5 years ago, then in Africa, he would be a freedom fighter, hero, liberator. I guess now, as we're reading the papers, Robert Mugabe, we're thinking slightly differently. But who is he really? Is he the cruel, evil dictator that our government says he is? Is he a misunderstood freedom fighter? Is he even just someone who's been driven mad by his years in power? Is he an old man gripping on to control and power? That's a very different question, isn't it? More difficult to decide. And actually, across the world, nearly everyone has an opinion on that. So let's try the man we're here to talk about this evening. Now we're warmed up. Jesus Christ, 40 times more hits on Google than Andy Murray and Robert Mugabe put together. Something like 20 films of his life just available at the moment if you went in the shops. He began his life's work at the age when tennis players retire. He was in it for about 3 years, which doesn't look like anything next to statesmen like Mugabe. But his 3 years was long enough to turn the world upside down. Empires have risen and fallen because Jesus Christ lived. Our world's most powerful man today, arguably, he famously got in some trouble for saying he takes orders from Jesus Christ. Our entire system of good and bad comes from him. Most of our laws come from things that he taught. We think it is 2008 this year because we think it is 2008 years since Jesus was born. New books on him come out every year. I bought two more at the weekend. But the first biographies of his life go on being global bestsellers. They're on your tables, actually, one of them. Pick up Mark's Gospel, which is the purple book on your tables. We're going to look at that in just a second. I guess you know, you knew immediately that was Jesus I was talking about, but had you noticed how extraordinarily popular and influential he still is? That this rumor, God is dead, Jesus is over. Had you noticed how amazingly popular he still is? It's extraordinary for a preacher who died so long ago. I am under no illusions. I'm a preacher. When I die, I will be forgotten extremely quickly. Why are we still Jesus of Nazareth? Why is he such a big deal? And I wonder if you'd thought about who he really is for a while. That's our topic today. There are more theories than for Robert Mugabe, and it matters much, much more who Jesus was. See, he's not famous for hitting a tennis ball. He's certainly not famous for beating up his opponents. He is famous for his claims and his promises. Jesus claimed to be God on earth in human form. He claims to be able to give human beings a perfect life forever with God. He claims he will conquer the world one day and that he will make the decision about whether you go to heaven or to hell. They're quite big claims. And as we talk about who is Jesus, I'm not asking you to vote Jesus for mayor of my life as if it was Ken or Boris. This is much more serious, much bigger than that. We're looking at the Jesus who is in charge of the world. And I'm asking you to open your eyes and recognize that. Will you see who he is really? Mark's Gospel, the book here, it really wants us to know. Mark, the writer, is obsessed with the issue of who Jesus is. It's one of the top things that keeps springing off the page. And he thinks he's given us what we need to answer the question. He thinks it's all here. So we're going to look at a short bit. Mark, as a writer, has direct access to the historical Jesus. Mark is sort of like the secretary, the PA for Peter, one of Jesus' closest friends. And we're going to look at who Jesus was, some things he did. Claire is going to read for us from page 8. So if you turn into page 8, and Claire's going to come up and read part of that chapter.
Looking at Mark chapter 3, verse 7, which, as Charlie said, is on page 8 of the books on the table. Starting at verse 7. Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the sea, and a great crowd followed from Galilee and Judea and Jerusalem and Idumea and from beyond the Jordan and from around Tyre and Sidon. When the great crowd heard all that he was doing, they came to him. And he told his disciples to have a boat ready for him because of the crowd, lest they crush him. For he had healed many, so that all who had diseases pressed around him to touch him. And whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, "You are the Son of God." And he strictly ordered them not to make him known. And then continuing to read from verse 20, which is further down on page 9. Then he went home, and the crowd gathered again, so that they could not even eat. And when his family heard it, they went out to seize him, for they were saying, "He is out of his mind." And the scribes who came down from Jerusalem were saying, "He is possessed by Beelzebub, and by the prince of demons he casts out the demons." And he called them to him and said to them in parables, "How can Satan cast out Satan? If a kingdom is divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. And if a house is divided against itself, that house will not be able to stand. And if Satan has risen up against himself and is divided, he cannot stand, but is coming to an end. But no one can enter a strong man's house and plunder his goods unless he first binds the strong man. Then indeed he may plunder his house. Truly I say to you, all sins will be forgiven the children of man, and whatever blasphemies they utter, But whoever blasphemes against the Holy Spirit never has forgiveness, but is guilty of an eternal sin. For they had said, he has an unclean spirit. And his mother and his brothers came, and standing outside, they sent to him and called him. And a crowd was sitting around him, and they said to him, your mother and your brothers are outside seeking you. And he answered them, who are my mother and my brothers? And looking about those who sat around him, he said, here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does the will of God, he is my brother and sister and mother.
Thank you, Claire, very much. Just as Claire goes back to her seat, did you see the obsession with who Jesus was? Did you see three times, three different opinions? People sometimes think the Bible is just sort of one message battered into you, Bible bashing. Mark is very relaxed about laying out the different options about who Jesus might be. Did you get the three? We have in verse 11, one group, the unclean spirits, say, you are the Son of God. Then in verse number 21, on page 9, you have his family, their view. He is out of his mind. And just the verse below, verse 22, the scribes say he is possessed by Beelzebul. There are three groups, basically, in this the verses we had read, and three different opinions about who Jesus might be. Mark has set it up deliberately, I think, as a multiple-choice exam, basically. That's what we have. I love multiple-choice exams. Last one I had to do was for a food hygiene certificate to work in a kitchen. And it's, you know, do you A, store the chicken in the bin, or do you B, store it in the fridge? That sort of, and they know that here. Your chicken is safe. But it's that sort of thing. So that's what we're going to do with Mark this evening. He gives you the three options in your multiple choice exam, and he thinks he's given you the evidence as well to make a decision. So let's start with the family. Start with the family. This is everyone with an embarrassing family. This is for you. Jesus had that as well. So look in verse 20. Jesus is so popular that it is stupid. Everywhere he goes, crowds pile on him. People form queues. They don't queue. They just pile in on top of him. In verse 20, he is in a house. He's gone home, and there's such a crowd that he can't even eat. Just imagine how many people there would have to be in your house before you couldn't make a sandwich. People sort of in every room, piled in the bathroom, people standing in the doorway, people in your fridge, people eating your sandwich. That is Jesus' life. Everywhere he goes, crowds pile to him. And he spends the whole day, morning to evening, teaching and healing and helping people. And his family come to visit. And it doesn't take much to see the scene, does it? So his mum comes around the corner and sees these crowds going mental. And, oh, what's going on here? Say, oh, is this bloke Jesus? He's the Son of God. He thinks he's God. He's the Messiah. And you can feel the mother's sort of anxiety, can't you? As she watches them fighting for a piece of her son and saying all these wild things about him. This is Amy Winehouse's dad saying, please don't buy my daughter's records. The fame is driving her mad. Please stop. So there's option one. Jesus is mad. He's a lunatic. He's a nutter. That's option one. And do you see how much that has going for it? None of these are sort of easy options to knock over. They've all got something going for them. Jesus the nutter. You see, he is claiming to be God. And we would normally have a very straightforward approach to people like that. His life looks wildly out of control, and his family just want to do the sensible thing. Verse 21, they want to seize him. And turn the page to 31 to 35. They sent and called him out. This is every teenager's worst memory. So here's Jesus in the house doing his healing and his teaching. And they come and say, Jesus, sorry, your mum's here. You'd better go. It's that sort of thing. And the family, it's really clear what their line is. Jesus, come with us. We're going to go for a nice walk. He's mad. And they need to rescue him. So there's option one, Jesus the mad, deluded idiot. Option two comes from the scribes. That's the verse below, verse 22. And they are the religious experts in the story. They're the ones who are worth listening to. And their option, verse 22, is to say he is possessed by Beelzebul. Now, if you're not up on your names of the demons, Beelzebul, it's not good. Basically, this is not a good reference. Jesus possessed by Beelzebul. He's the prince of demons. A fairly strong opinion that they have. He's satanic. He's evil, he's a liar, and he's a con man. He's casting out demons because he is a demon. That's what they're saying. It's just play acting. The whole thing's a setup. Now, and again, do you see how much that option has going for it? See, everything about Jesus is so big, in particular all of his claims. He actually looks dangerously full of himself as you read through and look at him. He says he's God. He expects people to worship him. He says that he is the person that all of history has been waiting for. He claims the right to tell people what to do. He takes over their lives. He looks manipulative. He is frighteningly powerful. There is option number two for an evil Jesus. Now, before we go to option number three, just notice what is not there. The option that isn't there, which is the option I was taught at school as the only one, which just isn't there. And nobody who actually met Jesus seems to have gone with it for long. And that is the option. I grew up with Jesus the Englishman. Basically, Jesus as Tim Henman compared to Andy Murray. That's basically the option I grew up with. Jesus the nice, kind man who's peaceful, wise, doesn't quite have the grit to win a tennis match, there to help with our lives when we need him. Actually, there's an overlap there with the view that my Muslim friends have of Jesus, and the view I understand is the majority Hindu view of Jesus as well, where he is a highly respected man. He's wise, he's from God, he's important, but he's not God. He's just a human being, someone to listen to. That is, I guess that's the majority global view, actually, when it comes to the question of who is Jesus. But do you see that only fits part of the fact? It sounds respectful and nice to Jesus, but it really only fits part of the fact. It ignores his claims. It ignores his own explanation of who he is. It just has to put that to one side. Religion and Jesus is wheeled out in this country when we need an injection of niceness. Are they misbehaving at school? Get the vicar in, talk about Jesus. Well, do you actually feel comfortable with that? Do you actually feel comfortable taking your sort of morals from the kind of person that we would happily put in a straitjacket if we met him today? Do you see what we said? The evidence for Jesus being mad, the evidence for Jesus being evil, and they're all true things about Jesus. And when you put them together, he just cannot have been a nice, happy man. How many moral teachers think that they are God? How many live crazy lives the way Jesus did? Or the evidence for evil Jesus. Is he really so nice when his teachings go with an absolute insistence on his own authority? I am God, obey me. In fact, he says, teach the world to obey me. It's quite a thing to say, isn't it? You may even, if you read Mark's gospel, you may even find yourself thinking, I don't like this man very much. I remember liking Jesus I heard about when I was young. But as I look at him himself, I actually don't like him very much. The nice option just isn't tenable for very long. So we've had two options. They've famously been summarized as the sort of mad or bad options for Jesus. He's either out of his mind, the family view, or he's satanic, the religious view. But the third option is the one that Mark has been rooting for all along. And Mark, he's a brilliant storyteller. This is not a boring book. He dummies it through, if you like. He has it in the story, but in the mouth of the most ironic group possible. In verse 11 and verse 12, Jesus is interacting with evil spirits, with unclean spirits. And they have no illusions. They see their enemy very clearly revealed. And in voices full of hate, they shout out, "You are the Son of God." So this is a multiple choice exam. And Mark has dummied past us the answer he thinks is the true one, the Son of God one, because he wants us to look at the other options, examine the evidence for them, exhaust the evidence, and then come back to what can only be the true answer. So that's why it sort of goes around. And the Mad Bad God thing was first presented like that by C.S. Lewis, whose stories are in films at the moment in cinemas. He was a Christian writer, and he put it like this. He said there are only three logical options for Jesus, who he can be. And I was quite pleased when I found Mark had got there before him. That was quite nice. But he could be mad, he could be evil, he could be bad, or he could be God. And C.S. Lewis, and I think Mark, means to exclude any other options. Please, you get to ask questions, please put down what you think all the options we've missed. But on the evidence of who he really is, you've got to either decide he's mad, or he's evil, bad, or he is God. And obviously that's the one I'm rooting for, that he's God. That's where I want to go now with the rest of our time, to tell you why I think that overwhelmingly fits the evidence of the real man Jesus. See, the mad option we can put aside in several very helpful ways. His teaching genuinely is wise and brilliant. He really is our best moral teacher that has ever lived. The things that sort of fit the nice Jesus say he can't be a madman. The human race really does work better when people turn the other cheek and forgive and go the extra mile. But also, his ability to deliver on his claims is what sets him apart from madmen. Madmen may say, "I am God," but they cannot heal sickness. They cannot raise the dead. The crowds we meet in this chapter are an absolute historical fact. We know that from contemporaries of Jesus who weren't Christians at all. Everywhere Jesus went, people crowded to him and they came to be healed. They came for the miracles. That's the slightly depressing fact in the Gospels. They're not really that interested in what Jesus says. And the sort of miracles he does, he takes someone's dead daughter and brings her back to life so that she is there every day in the town square kicking a football or whatever they did then. He takes the cripple that they would have walked past every day and flicked a coin at every day for 20 years. And then Jesus comes to town, and the next day he's running and walking and has his legs back. It's that sort of level of thing that madmen cannot do. Madmen can't do it. In fact, did you spot that verse 22 is a sort of spin strategy? This is Peter Mandelson at his best. See, the scribes are anti-Jesus. They want to stop him. They want to stop people believing in him. But they have a real problem, because they cannot deny his power. They can't just say these miracles are bogus. He's a magician. He's a con man. He really is casting out demons and emptying the hospitals and proving himself. So the only spin line available to them is to say that Jesus' power is evil power. It's real power, but they say it comes from Satan, because madmen couldn't do that. And his family actually didn't think he was mad for long. His brothers end up thinking he is God. I don't know if you're here as someone with a brother. Maybe your brother is even here. What would it take to convince you your brother was God? They change their minds. Which leaves the evil option. Can I recommend the evil option to you as your most realistic second choice? If you are unwilling to accept that Jesus is God, then can you see him as a cruel, evil, deceitful man, just seeing how long he can trick people into believing he's the Son of God, or worse, actually as satanic, if you believe in that? But even then, evil is only part of the picture here. It doesn't fit his teaching, it doesn't fit the good effect he has, it doesn't fit his amazing sinless life. They try to catch him on any charge they can, and the only one they can make stick at his trial is that he claimed to be king, the one that he's happy to be caught on. But actually, that isn't Jesus' answer. Just look down and get Jesus' answer from verse 23. Let me read you a couple of the verses there. So they call him Satan, and he calls them to him and said to them in parables, "How can Satan cast out Satan? If a kingdom is divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand." And then here's the parable in verse 27. "But no one can enter a strong man's house and plunder his goods unless he first binds the strong man. Then indeed he may plunder his house." In summary, Jesus points out how unlikely he is to be Satan, since he spends his life kicking Satan's head in. That's the basic summary there. his amazing power. Well, that's right, they've accepted that up to a point. But they haven't dealt with the amazing, positive, entirely positive way that he uses it. Jesus walks around his country, and everywhere he goes, Satan's influence is destroyed. People with demons, they end up whole, and then they're in their right minds. People who are dead end up alive. People who are sick end up better. People who are out of sorts with each other, bad relationships, end up cured. Why would Satan do that? Verse 26 calls that a civil war. Verse 24 says that's like dividing and weakening your kingdom. See, there is only one way to steal away the people that Satan has possessed. And that's in verse 27. Just like there's only one way to steal the possessions of a strong man. That is to be stronger. To wrestle him to the ground, thump him on the head, tie him up, and then you're free to plunder the place. If you want to clear out St. Helens this evening, very straightforward. All you need to do is wait till the end, knock me and Paul on the head. He's the stronger one. Start with him. Tie us to a chair, and then you can have as much cutlery as you want, or whatever it is you're after in here. Have a few statues. That's how it works, isn't it? Jesus says, that is what I've done. Can you not see, he says, what I'm doing is a complete plundering of Satan's kingdom. This is the rescue that God had always promised his people. Which comes back, can we finish here, comes back to the question of why this matters so much. See, the fact that Andrew Murray lost tonight doesn't really matter very much. The fact that probably deep in his Scottish soul he hates posh English people like me, that doesn't matter very much. But whether Mugabe is mad, bad, or a good leader, that matters hugely to the people who live under his rule and his authority. That's a deeply painful, important issue for them. And who is Jesus is right up there in that league, or higher. Because Jesus claims to be the ruler, the Lord, of every single person here, of your life and the whole world. So can I say, please don't just leave this issue. We were talking on our table about how it's easy, isn't it, to be busy in life, not take this seriously. Please take this away and read, and let Jesus in his own words, his own actions, shock you with who he really is. Particularly if you're here as a sort of nice Jesus person, if that's your view. Please let the man himself say for you. I guess it'd be good to pray about that if you're a praying person, or if you could bring yourself to do that. So you want to know who Jesus is. You want to understand this. We set up what we think is helpful. We set up some groups called Christian Explored. They're on the table as well. That's basically just a way of reading Mark in a group. Sometimes that's easier, isn't it? Sit around with some other people, bounce ideas off them, get their view of it, let them help you. Basically, we want to do anything we can here to help you read this through, come to see who Jesus is. So if he is a madman, then pity him briefly, and then ignore him for the rest of your life. If he is an evil man, then you need to cut his influence out of your life. You need to ignore his followers and try and persuade other people not to go near him if he's an evil man. But if he is God, and this is true, then he is the most amazing man who has ever lived. And in fact, in these verses, you have a picture of what he could do for you if he is God. See, if he's tied up Satan and evil and can steal you back from death and guilt and evil and rescue you. And also, he doesn't want to just put you in a cabinet and say that you are his. The very last verse Claire read, you see, Jesus takes being rejected by his family very well because he's building a replacement family. That could include people who are here this evening. Do you see verse 35 at the very end? He says, whoever does the will of God, he is my brother and sister and mother. To follow Jesus is to know him personally, to be in relationship with him, like being his brother or sister or mother. Sort of, you know, insert the one that fits your gender, fits your age. You could be that to Jesus, is what he's saying. And in my experience, that is the most fantastic thing in life. But it also fits the facts. That's where I'm going to end. I recommend you look into this urgently and act on this as soon as you can. We're going to stop there have pudding brought rounds. And please use the time. There's question slips on there. I'm aware some of the things I've said have been strong. So please write down any question you'd like to put to me, and we'll go through those in about 20 minutes.
Thank you for an excellent series of questions. We've got 30 or 40 questions. I've tried to group them together as best I can. We probably won't be able to get through all of them, I'm afraid, in the time that we've got allotted. We're going to make sure that we finish, I think, by quarter two at the absolute latest. So we don't want to keep you here all night, although do feel free to stay around afterwards and chat for as long as you want to. But some may need to slip off. Charlie, can I get you back up here? He's only had one mouthful of pudding, poor lad. But there we go. He needs feeding up, I think. We'll get him to eat it a bit later. Charlie, thank you for a really clear and compelling chat talk. Let me go straight in with some questions on the reliability of the Bible, which is obviously a key topic. In Mark's Gospel, we can see that Jesus is either mad, bad, or God, but how do we know that Mark's Gospel is an accurate representation? How do we know Mark didn't cover up other possibilities? How can we know that what he says about Jesus is true? How can we trust the Bible? There's a whole series of questions on that.
Thank you very much. Excellent series of questions on that, and I'd be very happy to be very boring about that for a very long time. My first degree was in history, and these are the normal history questions. I don't know if you've read Richard Dawkins' book on gods. There's a question that mentioned it later on, but he goes through questions like this and says, but who do people not ask about the Bible? Who wrote it, and when did they write it, and who were they, and could they have known, and did they make it up, and did they exaggerate it? And he asks that as if that is the most dramatic, revealing thing to say about the Bible ever. But reading that, as anyone with any, I don't know, even if you have history GCSE, you'll know those are the questions that you ask of any history text, any history book, any source ever. And so my brief answer would be, Mark's Gospel, you put through the same ringer that you would any other ancient document. We know it's an ancient document. We have copies of it from very close to the time it was written. We know it was written very early. I don't know if you were brought up on the idea that the Gospels were written 200 years after Jesus lived, that sort of thing. Scholarship has been moving away from that view, such that we're now saying Mark must have been written very early, must have been written by someone close to the events, and it looks like probably Peter's interpreter, like I said. That's something I couldn't prove to you absolutely historically, but it looks like that's the best option. So we do all the same sort of tests on it. How do we know Mark didn't cover it up? How do we know Mark didn't exaggerate it? That is from who is it written to? So he didn't write it, first of all, for us, sitting 2,000 years away with no video footage of Jesus' life. This was written and spoken, first of all, to the people who were there. The very first Christian sermon says, Jesus did these things as you know. One of the first Christian court cases, Paul is up in front of a Roman judge and a Jewish king, and he says, these things were not done in a corner. You know what Jesus did. So they're trying to persuade trying to persuade people who lived through these events and can say, hey, Mark, that's rubbish. I met Jesus. He was just nice. It's those sort of people he's writing to. So who was he? Why did he write? When did he write? All those sort of questions Mark stacks up to historically, the same sort of level of standard we'd put through any text. Is that?
And your conclusion after running through all of those things?
So conclusion after doing that is Mark's Gospel and the New Testament Gospels, all four of them, are as good as. So that I figured out really early in my history degree the way to make it easy was to specialise. I specialised in 1066. I reckon everyone knew what happened then. I'd stick there. The sources for Jesus 1,000 years before that are better historically than for 1066 and William the Conqueror in terms of actual access to the events. 1066, you have a tapestry by some nuns who weren't there 60 years later. You have a bloke who wasn't born. You have the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, who are really cross about the whole thing. And you have a couple of accounts by the biased Norman conquerors written quite a long time afterwards. And that isn't a problem. That's just normal history. Treat the Gospels as normal history. They're biased. They want you to believe Jesus is God. That's their angle. There it is, I've told you. But they're men who are there speaking to people who are there, trying to persuade you from evidence and facts. Read it like any other history.
It's worth saying that Charlie mentioned the Christianity Explored course that we run here from time to time. I would be very happy to address that question in more detail on Christianity Explored. Elspeth's got sitting on a resource table over there. Have you got something there on this question in particular? You have. So if you head over and see Elspeth over there at the table afterwards on your way out, then she'll be able to give you... There are varying lengths of literature that go from being a few pages long to several inches thick that we can give you to read on this topic in particular. It's really important. Do please keep asking on that. Charlie just doesn't want to be boring. He's not trying to sweep it under the table. Let's move on then to the...
It's asking for longer answers.
No, please, no longer answers. Let's move on to the Mad Bad God thing. You mentioned Richard Dawkins. In The God Delusion, he says there's a fourth option, which someone's pointed out here, that surely Jesus could have just been sincerely wrong. Why couldn't that be the case? Could he just have been sincerely wrong? How does that fit with your three options? Is he not just the nice bloke that I thought he was?
Thank you. So great questions. Could he have been sincerely wrong? So I don't know if you've read that bit in Richard Dawkins. I think that it's possible to find fourth options. A friend of mine believed that Jesus was an alien. I think that is a genuine fourth option that makes sense of some of the evidence. He's from another planet. He has access to technology they didn't have. Got this amazing sort of medical lab, beam me up, Scotty, something. I mean, that's a possible fourth option. But it's sincerely wrong. I think Richard Dawkins has just misunderstood C.S. Lewis. Sincerely wrong is included. So here's how it goes. Here's a man who tells you he is God. What are the options? So maybe he is sincerely wrong. He genuinely thinks he is God, but he's not. He's mistaken. I think for C.S. Lewis, that goes very quickly to he's a lunatic. Who else do you know who genuinely thinks they are God and isn't? I think it's there, it's included. Here's Jesus, he says he's God. If you think he's wrong, he's a nutter. Or he knows he's wrong and he's evil.
Lewis says he'd be on a par with someone who calls himself a poached egg, I think, or something like that, doesn't he? That it's just so utterly ridiculous.
So Dawkins breakfast. Yeah. Good. So some of the other questions like that. Does that mean he's not the nice, kind Jesus we're all taught about? No, he's brilliantly kind and nice. But he's so much more than Jesus the Englishman. This is Jesus who genuinely is God. And his niceness isn't just, please pull your socks up, please help grannies across the road. His niceness is, I have come to rescue you from Satan. Only I can do it. Come with me. Follow me. And that is a nice thing to do, I think, if it's true. He's a wonderful, amazing man. He's my closest friend. He's my main inspiration. All those things are true. But he is not nice if you mean to restrict him to that. He's just bigger than that. He blows that category.
Thank you. We've got some questions of clarification here. Why does Jesus call himself the Son of God rather than God himself? And then three or four questions on... There's a verse in the passage that was read where Jesus strictly ordered them not to make him known. And why would he not want people to know who he was if he really was God?
Thank you. So... Those questions have noticed I've been simplifying. I hope that meant we had a 20-minute talk rather than a 5-hour talk. That's right. So Jesus says, I'm the Son of God, or the demon said in our passage, he says it as well, rather than I am God. And there seems to be this sort of caginess about not wanting people to talk about it. Again, I hope you'll take the Mark's Gospels home with you and read them. And you'll notice that again and again through the first half of the book. He repeatedly says, don't tell anyone. I think that is because of the culture he's in. That's because of the situation he's in. Where to say that you are God is to have the people around you pick up stones to stone you to death. That's blasphemy. It's a very serious thing to do. And Jesus is quite happy doing that on a couple of occasions. They, in fact, quite often pick up rocks to throw at him and stone him. He's happy provoking that. But he has a three-year plan, if you like. He wants to teach particularly his disciples so they understand. He wants to demonstrate who he is. He wants to arrive in Jerusalem at the right time to be killed, because that is what his life is mainly all about. So I think he doesn't want to get it all over with quickly in a big flurry of rocks. So he says some things in a developing way. But also, knowing that's the culture gives you the context for understanding what Son of God means. So the people he's talking to are all... monotheistic, and it sort of very strong monotheistic Jewish people.
What does that mean?
They believe there's only one God and can only be one God, and to suggest otherwise is blasphemy, a very serious thing. And Jesus agrees with them. Jesus comes from that culture, Jesus affirms that absolutely. So when he says he is the Son of God, he's trying to explain who he is without disagreeing with there is only one God. He's saying that I am God, but I'm not a different God. I'm not a rival God. Not like there was the old Jewish God and I'm the new Christian God. That isn't what Jesus believes at all. He's not trying to set up that contrast. He says we are the same God, but I'm now explaining to you that God has always been in relationship, has been more than one person within one God. So Father and Son are inescapably relational words. Me and my baby son, we're not just sort of two blobs of matter that live in the same house. We relate, we love. And that is what Jesus is saying. He's trying to explain, I'm not a different God, I'm the same God, but I am God in three persons who relate and love each other. I just want to give you an example of that from John's Gospel. John's Gospel, chapter 5. So in John's Gospel, Jesus gets into a round of increasingly clear arguments with some people. And at one point, they pull him up for doing something on the Sabbath that he's not allowed to do. And Jesus' explanation is that, Luke's Gospel, not John's Gospel. Jesus' explanation is that it's all right for him to do it because his father works on the Sabbath. And in his culture, they understand him perfectly. They're angry with him for claiming to be equal with God. And Jesus, even though he is sometimes cagey, he doesn't sort of pull back from the brink and say, oh, hang on, oh, I'm not God. Let me explain, I'm just a prophet, or whatever. Jesus goes on from there to say things like, let me read you some highlights. Where am I going? Verse 23. He says, whoever does not honor the Son doesn't honor the Father who sent him. That is God's plan, is for the Son, Jesus, to be honored the same way as the Father. And no good man, no good prophet, no good preacher would ever say that. If you don't honor me, you don't honor God. He says things like, I have life in myself the same way the Father has. So Jesus is prepared to be absolutely clear on those things within the restraints of his culture. He wants to get through 3 years before he's killed. Did that get anyone near the question?
It did. I just want to pick you up on it, though, because you do sometimes hear people say, friends often ask me, well, look, I'm not happy with the idea that Jesus is God. I think he's only ever claimed to be the Son of God. Does he ever make it explicit? Does he ever say, I'm God? Surely, yeah, he didn't go that far, so why are you so keen to?
So I think Jesus makes it absolutely explicit in the terms of the people of the time, the culture of the time. They understand it. They pick up rocks to throw at him. He says, before Abraham was, I am. And they pick up rocks to throw at him. So he's that, again, for an educated Jewish reader hearing that, he's claiming to be pre-existent before their major religious figure. Same for Muslims as well with Abraham. And he's using the name of God in the Old Testament, I am. Those verses I just read, he's saying, as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son also to have a life in himself. He has things like, worship me, obey me, things like, I will judge the earth. The Father has given that to me to do. And I think we, in our culture, maybe think, maybe we're all sons of God. That's nice, isn't it? Maybe we're all in some way, you know, because we're human sons of God. And if there is that sort of thing, you can go some way with that. But in his culture, he is understood absolutely clearly. And you have to read a book through the eyes of the culture of the time. He's a Jewish man in a Jewish culture speaking to Jewish people. He says these things. They say, you're claiming to be God. Is that right? He says, yeah. And let me say some more things that wind you up even more. And then they want to kill him. That sort of thing.
I love that time in John where one of them comes up to him and says, Lord, just show us the Father and that'll be enough with us. Just show us God and we'll be able to see it. And then Jesus turns to the crowd and says, well, after all this time that I've been with you, do you still not know who I am? If you have seen me, you have seen the Father. He's absolutely explicit about it. And again, none of them were confused about. Thanks, Charlie. That's terrific. Let's move on to another series of questions. Can you elaborate on the... You okay? You doing all right?
Happy.
We've got another 10-15 minutes, I think, which is great. We're making good progress. Can you elaborate on the Jesus is God option? Is there any evidence? That sort of question.
Thank you. So I spend most of my time saying he can't be mad, he can't be bad, he can't be nice. The Jesus God option, I'd say, shines through his life. Once you realize those are your basic options, that's what you're choosing between, and it's not enough just to be patronizing and nice to Jesus, then I think you're constantly being pushed to, this man really is who he says he is. For me, and for the New Testament writers, the strongest place to go is the resurrection of Jesus. I don't know if you watched a few Christmases ago, there was a program with some magicians trying to recreate some of Jesus' miracles. Well, here is the one they could not do, which is where you allow yourself to be killed by a neutral or Roman authority, neutral government, in any way they want, to be checked that you're really dead, to be put without medical help for a day and a half, and then to appear again alive and persuade people you are not just sort of survived, but the Lord of life and God himself. That is the standard of proof that Jesus subjects himself to. That's what convinced them, and that's what convinces me. Again, it's an event in the past, and I'm not at all embarrassed about that. I think that's how we know most things that are important in life. That's how I know that Andy Murray lost his match because I believe Chris. And he told me he believes it because he's had his earphones in all night, hasn't listened to a word we said, and the BBC told him. And that is just how we do things. Witness evidence from people who were there. And I'd say read it. See what happened. See if you can explain it any other way. The people who were convinced by it said, we saw him die, I saw him alive again. And that is what has turned my life around. And thousands of them who were opposed to him, who wanted him killed, believe it the same way in the same very short time span. And for me, looking at it, I don't know any other way of explaining that. That there could be lots more I could say, but that'd be my main.
And again, I think there's a talk over on the resource table over there, and certainly available on our website, if not, that addresses the question of Jesus' resurrection in particular. One of these dinners we had a few months back, at which my boss, William, was speaking, and I think you've got copies of that over there, have you? Terrific. Charlie, you say, back on the options, you say he's either mad, bad, or God, but can't I be indifferent to who he is? What happens to me if I don't decide? Surely he can't be angry at me for this. And then again, what does it mean for me personally? A few questions like that.
Yeah. Thank you. Can I say, I think this is the main issue that our culture has with Christianity and with Jesus Christ. So we're a culture of take it or leave it religion, basically, or that let's not be too carried away religion. So you've understood me correctly as you asked this question, which is quite encouraging to me. I'm saying this is not optional. This is not a lifestyle choice. This is not you can sort of go your way and say, oh, you're a Christian, I'm a something else, and that's fine, isn't it? And I'm delighted you're here, whatever your religion is. I'm delighted to hear your view, hear why you think them. I'm delighted to chat through whatever. But the thing we can't do, if what Jesus is saying is true, is go away from here saying we disagree and that doesn't matter. Because if Jesus is right, then he's God in the sort of capital G proper sense, which means he created you, means that your life belongs to him, your property to him. And I think people hear the Bible category of sin or wrongdoing and just misunderstand it. Here it is, sort of naughty stuff that the speed camera flashes and you get a fine. Whereas the Bible doesn't talk about it that way. It affects grand theft of my life from Jesus. And for me, that was the big issue for me in coming to terms with Christianity, was realizing I actually needed Jesus' forgiveness. I wasn't an all right person. I needed something from Jesus. So two reasons. Let me clarify what I've just said. Two reasons. One, he is God. He's in charge of you. As I said, he will in the end decide whether you go to heaven or to hell. That's his claim, if this is true. And you can't just say, I prefer a different sort of music. It's not a sort of what you put on your iPod choice. This is, he owns you and will do with you what he wants. That's why it matters. But also, if he's right, the binding the strong man stuff, then you need him. Jesus' claim is the whole of this world is under the control of Satan. Not in a sort of pointy figure dancing around on your head, pulling the strings sense, but in which fits the world we see, a world full of dictators, a world full of suffering, a world full of all the evil that I do and cause despite my best efforts the other way. And Jesus says, I am the only one who can bust you out of prison on that. The only one who can take away your guilt, take away Satan's control of you, and set you free. It becomes like saying, "Oh, I'm indifferent to the man in the red uniform with the ladder who wants to get me out of my bedroom window while the fire is burning through my house." You could be indifferent, I guess, but I think we would call that stupid. By which I don't mean to be rude to someone who is in the process of thinking and deciding. But if I'm indifferent, I like to be indifferent, that's where I want to stay, you just haven't understood Jesus. Please change your mind and think he's an idiot or evil or wrong. That at least makes sense. But to be polite about him and indifferent makes no sense at all, given what he's saying.
Thank you. That's challenging stuff. So let me push you on how that works in practice. What's it like when you get out the ladder or get out the window and go down the ladder with him? I want to know Charlie, the man who says Jesus means more to him than anything else, Charlie, the husband, Charlie, the boss, the employee, the father. How does living, it sounded almost sort of authoritarian. He's the boss, he's going to tell me what to do. Is it a better life? You know, tell me what it's like in practice.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. In a sense, it is authoritarian. Jesus says, obey me. He's Lord. But the clues are there in our passage. It's freedom being rescued, taken away from control of Satan. And genuinely, that is freedom. My best days are when I follow Jesus' advice in how I am with my wife or with my colleagues or with my family. My best days are when I try and run my life his way. That is real freedom. It's also wonderful the way the passage ends in terms of family. So Christians are not on their own. Christians are connected to the God of the universe through Jesus Christ, who calls me brother, which, if what we've said tonight, is just an extraordinary thing to say, to have the one who is God, who made the universe, even know my name, but much more to say, this is Charlie, my brother, my friend. And that day-to-day is a fantastic thing. And particularly when... So for me, the big issue was... you may think this is completely ridiculous, but I was a religious upbringing, just thought I was a good person. I thought God should be happy to have me rather than the other way around. And having realised that was arrogant nonsense, to see Jesus, who forgives me despite the way I am, and then calls me brother, that's an incredible way to live.
Thank you. Let me just pick you up on the negative of that a bit more. We had a few questions about that line, whoever blasphemes against the Holy Spirit never has forgiveness but is guilty of an eternal sin. This just sounds totally unlike the Jesus I know. I thought Jesus was supposed to be all forgiving. How could something be unforgivable? It goes against the very point of Christianity.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I need that. It might be worth turning up page 9 again. It's a great question. The question says this doesn't sound like the Jesus I know, which I think that's right. The nice Jesus wouldn't say that, would he? The nice Jesus wouldn't turn to someone and say, you have committed an unforgivable sin. I think Mark is aware people will have this question and wants to make it absolutely clear what this means. So he does it by doubling up something, which he's normally very efficient with words. Do you see in verse 30... he says, for they had said he has an unclean spirit. So that's a repetition of the sort of thing they'd said in verse 22. So the thing they've done, which is unforgivable, is calling Jesus Satan. Now, why is that unforgivable? So it's not something you can do by mistake in the playground. Sort of, oops, say Holy Spirit as a swear word or something, and then suddenly that's it, you're damned forever. That isn't the point. It is these highly intelligent experts, religious experts, looking at Jesus, evaluating him, and saying that's satanic. And I think the reason that is an unforgivable sin is because Jesus is the only place forgiveness comes from. Jesus is where forgiveness comes. He's the source of it. His death is the only reason why God can forgive people. He's the only one who can forgive sins. So if you see the only place you can have forgiveness and say that's satanic, then you have cut yourself off absolutely from the source of forgiveness. And they have done that it's not like they made a mistake. They've done that in an absolutely deliberate absolutely final way. I'm actually not decided whether, in what sense it means eternal. So, and I suspect it's more like the person who says, I'm never going to read a book, is guilty of eternal ignorance, because books are where you get knowledge from, but actually could sort that one out by changing their mind and going and reading a book. So do you see what I mean? I think that's probably more like it, that it's the anti-Jesus spirit, while you're there, is eternal, rather than if you've said it once, that's it, you're locked out. So everywhere else in Jesus, he's willing to forgive. And we know actually some of these, or significant numbers of these same religious leaders believed in Jesus after his resurrection and were given every assurance of forgiveness because of doing that.
Thank you. I think we've got one more question probably, which is this one. I'll ask it from both sides because we've got both options. Why can't I just live the way I want to live, doing what I want to do now, enjoying life, and then become a Christian when I'm old? So the sort of negative of it. More positively, if we believe Jesus is the Son of God, what are the consequences? What should I do about it?
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think for me that's a very encouraging question, actually, the negative version of it. Because that is someone who's understood what I'm saying tonight in both its sort of the good side and the bad side. You've understood I'm saying this is really important and that you definitely want to have it sorted out before you die. That's sort of that. To not do that is again, that's sort of irresponsible in the way that not climbing down the ladder with the firemen is. But also you've understood this is deeply uncomfortable. I wasn't joking when I said, you know, if you don't want to accept that Jesus is God, can I recommend thinking that he's evil? Because I think the choice is often at the level of what you want. Can you see how inconvenient it would be, in a sense, to be a Christian, to believe that Jesus is God? It would mean obeying him. It would mean putting him at the center of your life. It would mean thinking the things he says are true. It would mean running your life around him. And I can quite understand why someone would want to delay that so as to live the nice life. I think it would be a terrible, terrible shame because of what I said earlier in my answer to Paul. So that person is denying themselves years and years of knowing Jesus as their rescuer, as their brother or sister, as their friend, years and years of guilt-free life. I do all sorts of things wrong. I go to Jesus, I say sorry. He says, I've already died for them. You were forgiven for those the moment you became a Christian. And that is an extraordinary place to live your life from. Extraordinary place to forgive other people from. Way to shape your life. Also, just so Jesus is brilliant. His teaching is brilliant. Following him is excellent way to live. You're missing out on all of that. Also, can I call your bluff slightly? The world is not full of octogenarians queuing up to become Christians. The experience actually is decisions come and go, don't they? So maybe tonight is the first time some annoying person has laid out the, come on, who do you really think Jesus is? That means tonight is your best place to start thinking about this, investigating, possibly your best place to respond to this. Normal experience of life is that as you move on, as there are issues, other things, maybe things you want to do with your life that Jesus says don't, actually you fossilize in that direction. Most people as they go through life become more fossilized and more stuck with where they are. So to do that is really dangerous, I think, to say, yeah, Jesus, I'll come back later. I guess you won't. Maybe you will, but I guess you won't if you don't do something about it tonight. What are the consequences? Jesus says you need to give up your life and die. That's how he describes it. In the middle of Mark's gospel, finally his disciples get who he is. And they expect a sort of big party, but immediately he says, to follow me is to take up your cross and die. Which means to be willing to give everything to Jesus every day, up to and including the point where it cost me my life, the same as it cost Jesus. This isn't a light thing. We're not asking you to vote for mayor, Jesus as mayor or something. This is much bigger than that. But again, to say that is freedom. Because that is living the way we're meant to be. Human beings were not meant to be living their life without God, stealing their life from God. We're meant to be living for God, who made us, loves us, intended us that way. It's like putting a fish back in the sea to live the way it's meant to be. That we're all, as human beings, we're gasping in the air without Jesus, without that. Even though I definitely don't want to pretend that that living as a Christian is anything other than the way Jesus describes it. Often hard, difficult, and annoying.
I said it was the last one. If someone says, how do I do that? They say, I'm with you, I'm persuaded that he's God. I know it's going to be painful following him, but I see that it's going to be the best thing. I want to do it. How do I do that?
That's a great question. Again, I think Mark wants to help you with that. The book is designed to do that. In chapter 1, Jesus says, repent and believe in me. And through the book, you get examples of people coming to terms with that and trying to do that. Repent just means make Jesus your Lord and God. Say, recognize I've been making myself Lord and God. That's what it was for me. Maybe for you, your career or something else is your Lord and God. Make Jesus your Lord. Say, I want now to follow you. And I trust Jesus and I just trust your death to deal with my sin, to deal with everything I've done wrong. That's what believe means. You put your trust in the dinner by eating it this evening. It's that same thing. Put your trust in Jesus by living his way, by wanting, trusting his death is the only thing that will get you to heaven.